You're listening to the Hog Sports Network Daily Podcast. Now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
Today on the show, Joe Healy from D1 Baseball's SEC Extra stops by to talk about the Razorbacks, the Longhorns, ahead of this weekend's big series at Baum Walker Stadium. We'll also talk to him about what's going on at Mississippi State and everything else that's big news in the league. Christina Long will also stop by the studio, and we'll talk about what Dave Van Horn had to say about playing Texas this week. But first, a word from Kendall King.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Joe Healy's one of the best in the business from D1 Baseball. He runs their SEC Extra site, and he joins us now. Joe, Texas, what's made them so good this year?
I think the part of it is this little – they kind of seem to have this – they're the team this season that seems to have kind of the magical elixir to win close games. That's been part of it, is that it seems like every coin flip game, the coin falls, you know, with the Texas logo showing up instead of the other team. So that's one. Two is that their pitching staff has been excellent. They're in SEC play, their ERA in conference competition is a run and a half better than anybody else in the league. So far and away, the best pitching staff in SEC play. And, you know, we could talk about where they're a little bit vulnerable, that the pitching staff is not the deepest pitching staff that we've ever seen, but they have five guys they really trust. They have six or seven they at least kind of trust. And those guys have all been really, really good. So those are the two main things. I think it also helps that it's a veteran position player group. Not the most dynamic offense, not the most physical offense. And they're short a player because Max Ballew, their best hitter, is out for the year. But it's a good offense that kind of helps, just does enough when their pitching staff has been as good as they've been.
You know, one of the guys that I was able to watch a lot of their series with A&M last week, with Arkansas being on the road, and, you know, the times just seemed to work out. I was really impressed watching Dylan Volantis in the back end. I mean, big left-handed freshman, and he doesn't throw like a freshman. I mean, this looks like a guy that's been doing this for two or three years in the college game.
Yeah, he's probably been, if you force me to pinpoint the specific on the pitching staff of why it's gone the way it has, he would be the guy, because you're right. He doesn't look like a freshman in any way, shape, or form. And I think one of the things that's most impressive about him is he's got 99 in his bag. Like, he can absolutely blow up past hitters, but he'll have outings where he'll throw 30 pitches and throw two fastballs. Like, he just, you know, he's got such a varied arsenal that, you know, it's a luxury to have 99 at the left side, and he doesn't necessarily need it to get out. So I think he's a future Friday guy for Texas, you know, and could have frankly been in the rotation this year if they'd needed that, but they had other guys that have been effective, and so they've been able to use him in this kind of versatile bullpen role, and he's been about as good as it gets.
Texas, you look at the teams they played on the road, and they're not good teams. I mean, it's Mississippi State. Oh, Mississippi State's got a chance maybe to make the tournament. We'll see, and I want to talk to you more about that situation here in a minute, but it's Mississippi State, it's Missouri, and it's Kentucky. And I wonder how you think Texas is going to react this weekend, because this is going to be, without a doubt, probably the most hostile environment they've stepped into this year.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's the big test. That's what I'm looking for this weekend, too. I think if Texas is going to get got, it seems like this weekend is probably when it's going to happen. Because, yeah, they haven't really been tested on the road in the way that every other SEC team has. And that's going to be, just in the big picture, that is going to be something interesting when we talk Field of 64 time on Memorial Day, is intra-conference scheduling, because in these mega conferences, of which the SEC is one, you don't play everybody. Who you get at home versus road really matters. Mm-hmm. And, oh, by the way, there's always a team that's just having a tough season, but we've never had a team like Missouri that is just frankly not competitive game to game. And will the committee look at the teams that played Missouri differently than the ones who didn't? I don't know. Or the ones who had to go to Missouri, like, as opposed to another road series. I don't know that, but it is an interesting situation, because there is this albatross in the league of a team that is just not on the level of everybody else.
You think Missouri goes 0-30?
Unfortunately, I think I would give it a better than 50% shot, honestly. And you know, they were going to struggle to begin with. The roster's not particularly good, but then they've also been just ravaged by injuries, and so they, you know, they don't have the high end skill or depth, or you know, they're just, it's not just they're going with a knife into a gunfight. They're going with a knife into nuclear warfare is essentially what I've compared it to. So tough season there for the Tigers and what's been a kind of a tough existence in the SEC.
This is two times now in the last 4 years that Jim Schlossnagle has gone into an SEC program and had a huge year over year turnaround. He did it at A&M in 22, and now he's doing it in Austin. Is this a byproduct? And maybe it's multiple things, Joe. Is it his coaching ability? Is it his reputation and his ability? And maybe this is a byproduct of what's going on with the game now. Is it easier to turn these types of programs around year over year than, say, 5-10 years ago, you think?
Yeah, it is. You know, just the player movement makes that the case. And if you're someone that has Schlossnagle's cachet, it makes it even easier because, you know, players want to go there. At least some subset of players want to go there. Because the guy wins and they know that he's going to win. Now, it helps in this case. This was not the case at A&M, but it helps in this case that most of the Texas players who could come back came back. And so there was a level of continuity on this roster that you don't typically see with a first-year coach in a new place. So he did have a little bit of an advantage there, but I think you're right to kind of look at that and wonder, you know, how he pulls it off, because it has been pretty impressive. I'd say the other thing is, and this might sound like a criticism, it is absolutely not. Like, Jim Schlossnagle is not interested in anything except how to make his team better and how to win games. Like, he's, you know, he's not the warm, fuzzy guy. Like, he's not, you know, he's not a character. You know, he's not, he doesn't have a ton of personality. You know, he's not particularly, you know, chummy with his players or anything like that. He's not any of those things. The dude just wants to win. And so he's laser focused on doing that at the expense of a lot of other things. And that's an effective approach. So it is a combination of things, but certainly, you know, his ability to just know exactly what you need to do to put a winning product on the field immediately is a big part of it.
One more on Texas, then I want to ask you about the Razorbacks. This pitching coach, Max Wiener, he was with him at A&M last year. They were phenomenal on the mound, or in Texas is this year too. The coaches that I've talked to about him, they just rave, and they say that this guy has really ascended quickly to being considered one of the very best pitching coaches in the business. How long do you think they can hang on to him before these programs that have head coaching vacancies come calling?
Well, that'll be interesting because it on paper you'd think, man, it may not be long because he is a rising star in this business. But the other part of it is, you know, being a head coach has never been more different than it is now from just being a coach, right? Like, it's so much CEO stuff. It's so much roster management stuff, you know, all that stuff. And so do you lose some of what makes him so good as a pitching coach if you have him as your head coach, right? So some of that will carry over for sure, but that is a question a program's going to have to ask. I actually wonder if the scenario that Texas has to worry about a little more is a big league club coming and poaching Max Wiener, just because he is respected that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe he just loves the college game, right? Wes Johnson came back from being a big league pitching coach. So that's not unheard of, but he is he's an interesting story too. Like, listeners should look up, you know, kind of his story. Like, he's something of a prodigy. Like, he was a renowned pitching coach in his 20s. Like, he started a business in his, maybe even his late teens, on pitching development. And so he's just kind of been this guy who's been very, very successful from a very, very young age. And the guy's younger than you and I, Matt, by quite a bit. And he's one of the best pitching coaches in the country. And, you know, it will be interesting to see his path, because I do think the sky's the limit for him.
Of course, he was with the Mariners before he went to A&M. Right. So he does have that pro background. Arkansas, you look at them, they're 37-9. They're 14-7 in the SEC. And if that's all you know about the Razorbacks, you say, wow, you know, what a run they're on. It's been a little rough here the last few weeks, not being able to close out these series. What do you think about what you've seen from the Razorbacks? And I wonder, you know, when you see, like, in the RPI right now, they're number 5, and then there's a lot of ambiguity about where they're ranked. One poll's got them 5, one poll's got them 12. All 5 of the polls have them in a different place. Where do you see them right now, and how this fits into their postseason resume?
I think in the big picture, they're kind of right where, maybe they're a couple games back of where I assumed they'd be at this point, but I think it's important to take the big picture context of, you know, if you said before the season Arkansas would be 14-7 in the league and kind of sitting where they are, like, I think, okay, you know, maybe I would have thought a game or two better, but that's right about, so I think the big picture goals are all still in play. I think a lot of the just the discrepancy in the polls and, you know, the three straight series losses is, I think, largely just a function of what the SEC is this year, which is you've got Texas, and then you've got a group of 6 or 8 teams, maybe, that you've got 6 or 8 teams kind of in this bunch that I'm not sure from game to game who is the best of the group. You know, it's LSU, it's Tennessee, it's Arkansas, Georgia, Vanderbilt, you know. So I think that's just kind of a function of what it is, where you look at the Georgia series, that's a perfect example of, I actually think, I was at that series, I think Arkansas was the better of the two teams in the field that weekend. Hmm. But Georgia hits a walk-off home run and wins another close game, and voila, like there it is, a series loss. So I think that's kind of what's happening here. So in the big picture, I don't have any major concerns. All the big picture goals are still in play. I still think it's a team that plays home baseball in June. But certainly a team that it has not been as smooth sailing for as I assumed it would be once we put them number one before that Georgia series. And I kind of thought that, hey, this team is going to be ascendant, and I liked them to win the SEC, and it hasn't been that. But within the context of our preseason expectations, I think they're still right there.
When, you know, 14-7 this time of year in a lot of years, you're right in the thick of the SEC race. But right. What Texas is doing is historic. There's only two other teams who've had 19 wins through their first 21 games, Tennessee in 22, Vanderbilt in 13. And, you know, obviously those are two of the great teams that have ever played in this conference. You know, for the Razorbacks, you mentioned you think they'll be playing home baseball in June. And there's a lot between now and Memorial Day when the selections are made. They play Texas, and then they play LSU, and they play Tennessee. I mean, this is as tough of a 3-week stretch as I think anybody's going to play all year long. How do you think this might go for them, knowing that they've got a couple of these at home?
Yeah, I think it's knowing that they got a couple at home, you're looking to go 5-4. Like that's kind of the long and the short of it. And if you do that, I think you're in top 8 range. The RPI is not going to go anywhere. So if you're a Razorback fan, no, don't take this to the bank. But I'm pretty confident telling Razorback fans, like, the RPI is going to be fine as a top 8, because playing those three teams is not going to affect that whatsoever. So there's if you go 5-4, Arkansas is going to be right there, but it is a tough finish. And so if we're having a different conversation, if they go 2-7 or even really 3-6, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you lose all three of those, because now you're looking at a team that will have lost, you know, a bunch of series in a row, and they're going to be a tough team to peg, because the RPI will be good. The record will be decent, but they will have come in on quite the skid. And that's the other function of the SEC this year, is that the conference records almost, I don't want to say they don't matter, because they will to the committee. That's Joe's opinion, but they seem to be kind of divorced from, you know, the RPI rankings and what have you, because the league has been so good, because you added Texas and Oklahoma and they've been value adds to the league as opposed to being drains on the league.
Vahiva Aloy, where do you think where does he stack up in the conference player of the year conversation? Because I would think he has to be in it.
I think so too. Like, I might, you know, I'd have to really take a hard look at it, but honestly, I think he might be the player of the year, because it has been a little more of an open year, right? There's no Charlie Condon that has 30 home runs already or whatever. There's no Jack Caglione who's hitting .450 and has 30 home runs. Like, there's not that one player in the league this year. And I think partially that's because power's down in the SEC. The ball's just not flying, and there are some theories about that, like the baseball may be a little bit different than what we've been using the last couple of years. So I think he's right there. And I'll say this, like, we're working on a straw poll for Golden Spikes here at D1 Baseball, like, just pick your top five players, and we haven't released the results of that yet, but mm-hmm. Vahiva was on my list. So I mean, he's not just an SEC player of the year discussion, but he's in the national player of the year discussion with guys like Alex Lodis from Florida State. Like, that's kind of the level he's on right now.
Yeah. And I was thinking about this. And you probably do too. I vote in the Hauser Trophy, which is the other national player of the year. And those ballots are, or I guess the first round of those ballots are going to be coming out pretty soon. it's not as easy this year to find, you know, like last year it was like, okay, you got Charlie Condon, you got Jack Caglione, you've got Hagan Smith, you've got Travis Bazana. There were a lot of just very, you know, duh choices to put on that ballot. I don't feel like it's that way this year.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like last year, to your point, you know, you could have submitted a ballot with any of those four names on it. And no matter, you know, you could have submitted that ballot now with one of those four names on it, and it still would have looked like a solid choice, you know, once everything was wrapped up. There really was no wrong answer there. And this year it's, you know, I would use an example of Iva Arquette, who's playing at Oregon State. Like he, you know, was kind of in that mix, but I was here in Oregon over the weekend and he had a really tough weekend against the Ducks, and all of a sudden, you know, his numbers have taken a hit. So right now it does feel like it's sitting a little bit on a razor's edge where one bad weekend, you know, could really, or one great weekend on the other end of the spectrum could really change this race.
Mississippi State, they fired Chris Lemonis this week. Maybe a little bit surprising, not because it's surprising, I think, in the sense, Joe, that they were still a tournament, but you know, a team with tournament potential this year. They're not totally out of it by any means. You look at what they've done since they won the championship in 21, and it's been an obvious, you know, fall off the cliff. But why do you think it went wrong for Mississippi State the way it did? Because really, there just aren't a whole lot of teams out there that put more resources into baseball than they do in Starkville.
I think some of it comes down to coaching style. Chris Lemonis is famously a player's coach. Players like to play for him. There's kind of a reason why, even when it was going bad, you didn't tend to hear a lot of, you know, even off the record or just in whispers, like really negative things about that locker room or about that program culture or anything like that. Players like to play there, but you do need a strong locker room to pull that off. And when you look at the team that won the national title, you had guys like Jake Mangum and Elijah McNamee and Ethan Small and guys who had been around the block a time or two. And oh, by the way, a team that had dealt with the drama of Andy Cannizzaro, and then he got fired, and then Gary Henderson got him to Omaha as an interim, and then Chris Lemonis comes in. Like, that's a lot for a team to deal with. So I think that was a particularly close group that won the national title. And then the roster turns over after that, and I just don't think there's been that same kind of core leadership on the roster and guys who thrive under that kind of more hands-off player-led culture, players coach kind of situation. Now, that's not all there is to it. I also think that in this era of college sports, roster building is just different. They continue to recruit at a fairly high level, but look at the players who have gone in the transfer portal to Arkansas and Tennessee and LSU and to some extent Georgia, and then look at Mississippi State. And they just weren't necessarily fishing in the same pond in terms of the player. Now, they've had some nice players come in via the portal, but they haven't had those game-changing superstars via the, at least not on the level of those other teams. And so I think that's a part of this too, and it does beg the question of, will they be more of a player in that pool moving forward with whoever their next head coach is?
They shoot the moon. Who do they get?
I would say Brian O'Connor at Virginia. Now, I think people might be a little bit surprised to hear that as an option, given that he's so entrenched at Virginia. He's been there 20 years. He goes to Omaha all the time. They won a national title. But I think he's ready for a new challenge. My buddy Kendall Rogers has reported that he was really involved with A&M last year before they ended up going a different direction. So he's kind of, I think, ready for a new challenge, ready to try something a little bit different. I think also ready to be at a place where I think he gets a lot of things at Virginia, but I think he's ready to be at a place where a program is ready to just kind of open up the war chest for him. And certainly I think Mississippi State is going to be eager to do that, to get back on the level they think they should be at. So for me, it's Brian O'Connor. Anytime you can bring in a guy who's that proven, who's been to Omaha that many times, has won a national title, and oh, by the way, has the demeanor, I think, to deal with Starkville. That's a fishbowl. The baseball program is under a hot spotlight. And he's just a cool, calm, even-keeled guy who I think is going to let all that stuff roll off his back, because he knows he doesn't have anything to prove to anybody. You know, and he's just going to be focused on winning.
Last one for you, Joe. The SEC basketball, they got 14 teams into the NCAA tournament. You think baseball can match that?
It could, but the pieces have to move just so, right? You need Mississippi State to get to get hot and kind of make a run, which I think they could do just because, like, they're probably going to play loose and free the rest of the way, feeling like they're just playing with house money. Nobody expects anything. It kind of reminds me of the Brad Bohannon situation with Alabama a couple of years ago, where that team just played awesome after his dismissal. Mm-hmm. So I think that's on the table. But they can't do that at the expense of another team that's kind of on that bubble. So if you made me pick, I'd say 13 is the number for me. I think whether it's Mississippi State or somebody else, I think somebody else is just going to miss. But I think a year when there will be 14 is coming. I just don't think this year's the year.
Of course, basketball, they've got 68 teams, and one or two of those SEC teams had to play the play-in game in Dayton. So that makes a difference, too. Joe, you do a great job. We appreciate you coming on.
Appreciate it, Matt. See you, man.
I appreciate it. Joe Healy from D1 Baseball. When we come back, Christina Long will join me in studio. But first, another word from Kendall King.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Hey, welcome back. I want to tell you about our friends at Bentonville Glass. They've been serving their community since 1971. Committed, professional, versatile. If you are looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can come by and see them at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at BentonvilleGlass.com. I'll tell you, too, you can get the latest breaking news on all Razorback sports at WholeHogSports.com. Most in-depth source for all Razorback sports with analysis, latest in recruiting, unique stories on all your favorite teams. Subscribe today at WholeHogSports.com. Christina Long is here in studio with me. She just wrapped up listening to Dave Van Horn preview Texas. The big takeaway, I guess, Christina, is that Carson Wiggins, initially, the tests are no tear in the elbow, but further testing is going to be needed.
Right. So it was funny the way that he phrased it. He talked about how the first MRI that he had earlier this week was positive, and then we followed up with, okay, positive as in good news or positive as in positive for a tear? And he said there's no tear. So positive as in good news is what it seems. So if you hear the clip from Dave Van Horn somewhere and you hear him say positive, he means good news. It was kind of confusing. It was very funny. But so, yeah, he said that he will have another test today using that dye. It's that contrast MRI, which you mentioned that
I think it was Dylan Carter.
Yeah, Dylan Carter had the same thing, and it was a similar deal. First MRI said no tear, and then they got in there with the dye, and it's a more thorough, it's a better look, and that revealed that he did have a tear. So could be a situation like that. We probably won't get to find out until we talk to Coach Van Horn after the game tomorrow. So that's kind of the big update. You know, there's a couple of other injury things. Logan Maxwell, he said, is going to be available this weekend, but he's not entirely sure about using him in the outfield yet. He said maybe we can pinch hit him a little bit, but it sounds like that is an issue and something that's kind of ongoing. It doesn't sound like he's fully going to be 100% for this weekend. So those are kind of the big personnel notes for this weekend.
With Wiggins, just because it's a strain, if that's what it ends up being, it doesn't mean he's going to throw again this year. I mean, you think about Brady Tigert. When he strained his elbow last year, it cost him 8-9 weeks. And so I would be very surprised, even if they get the best news possible on Wiggins, that we see him again this year. If they're fortunate and it is only a strain, there's not a tear in there, at least that means that he could pitch next season. Because if you end up getting a torn elbow at this time of year and you have to undergo Tommy John, and there are other procedures, we're getting real ahead of ourselves, but if it's worst case scenario and a pitcher at this time of the year would have to have Tommy John surgery, a lot of times that means that it's going to cost you your next season too. You mentioned Dylan Carter. It was this time in April of 23 whenever he got hurt, and he was a very quick rehab from Tommy John surgery. It doesn't always happen that way. So, I think for Wiggins' sake, for the Razorbacks' sake, if he can have this test today and it comes back negative with positive news, I think that would be the way to say it.
Exactly.
you know, then you get to see him in a Razorback uniform again. Because I got to tell you, he's going to go pretty high in the 26th draft. If you don't know, he's a draft-eligible sophomore. He's number 48, I think, rated player in college by Baseball America for that draft class. So, you know, enjoy him in a Razorback uniform while you get to see him. You mentioned Logan Maxwell. Right field is a very interesting place right now for the Razorbacks because I don't know what you do there. You play Kendall Diggs. He's not hitting.
Yeah.
You play Carson Bowles, and there's some defensive liability there.
And the offense isn't rewarding enough for it to be worth it.
You play Kahlil Alloyan, right? I mean, they tried him out there in a midweek game. They said that he's gotten better from where he was in January,
February. But does better mean serviceable? Does better mean playable in an SEC game?
He committed an error in the one game that he did play during the midweek. Very interesting right now what Arkansas does with right field. And this is the way it works when you have got an issue in the field, the ball's going to find them. That's just how it works.
Yeah.
And so it'll be interesting to see what happens this weekend with that. Even getting Logan Maxwell's bat, you know, and this is what's interesting. He says they may DH Logan Maxwell. Mm-hmm. Well, they're not gonna take Kahlil Alloy out of the lineup.
He said they might pinch hit him.
Pinch hit.
He didn't mention DH, but you said pinch hit. They've done that before, you know, when he was early in the season, they just had him at DH, but that was kind of before Kahlil.
Okay.
We knew Kahlil was what he was.
Okay.
So I think they might pinch hit him, you know, try to get him in where they can. But yeah, it sounds like he might not be good for the field.
Okay. So I'm getting ahead of myself there. Anyway, right field.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting going into the series.
I want to add another note. You mentioned injuries, pitchers, Hunter Dietz. He said Hunter Dietz had a really good session yesterday, threw live yesterday, best he's thrown since he's been hurt. So he said, you know, he'll be available, but he's been available for the last couple series. And then, you know, he had the freak eye injury.
Did he say whether or not that kept him from playing against Florida?
He didn't say if that Florida? Was what kept him. He did say kind of the same thing he said going into the series before he got hit in the eye in the bullpen was, you know, we want to get him in, but it's going to depend on the right situation.
Okay.
So I guess it wouldn't surprise me if you don't see him this weekend if they're playing really tight games because they just don't know what they're going to get from him yet. And so in a real game. And so I think they would have to have kind of the right conditions. I think they feel good about where he's at injury-wise. It's just, you know, so is he going to go out there and have a Gage Wood first game back type experience and then it costs you a close game against Texas?
As you heard Joe Healy say earlier, Texas is kind of the king at playing tight games. This season. One of the other big personnel notes that you haven't mentioned is Landon Beidelsees is not being named as a starter. It doesn't mean he won't start game three. It just means that they're going to TBA this and see what's available when Saturday rolls around.
Is that something that coaches do from a sending a message standpoint, or is it truly just because they're kind of waiting and seeing how the series takes shape?
I think it's the latter of those two. I think what happens is that, you know, if you get into a situation – you know, let's say Texas stacks some left-handers, and you think Landon Beidelsees could go out there and give you an inning in a real pivotal situation out of the bullpen. I think that he could, you know, you could potentially see him there. You know, I think it's, you know, maybe you don't have to throw Aiden Jimenez the first two games, and maybe you start him.
Yeah.
You know, who knows what the case is.
It would kind of surprise me if they don't have to use Jimenez in one of the first two games.
Well, though. I think that's probably true.
You know.
I think that's probably true, but...
But you don't know. It just depends how it takes shape. Yeah.
You never know. I mean, a game may get away, and you don't have to use him. Maybe two games get away. Maybe it's a blowout one way one day, and it's a blowout the other way the next day, and he's not needed in the bullpen. So so it'll go Root game one, Wood game two, TBA game three, and with Gage Wood, we're looking at a pitch count of somewhere around 50 to 60 pitches this week.
Yeah, leveling him up from where he was. And, you know, I was talking to somebody about this last night where I'm interested with Wood. We have such a limited sample size for him this year because he just had the two games and then now he's just had the two limited outings. And the first one went poorly and the second one went great. And so it's like, okay, where is it going to fall? You know, it's got to be somewhere in between, right? So, you know, I'm wondering if this weekend will be that kind of return to the middle sort of, you know, good, a solid outing, as opposed to where he was lights out last week versus had nothing the week before. Is it going to fall on one end of the spectrum or are we going to land somewhere in the middle with him?
really good. I mean, he's been really good for three of the four outings.
Yeah.
I mean, like really, really good. And I think if they can get an extended version of what they got against Florida last week, which was honestly what he gave them for two innings against Michigan, what I think he gave them for the better part of five innings against Washington State, that bodes well for everybody. It gives you more innings out of the starters. It takes some of the pressure off of the bullpen. They need Gage Wood to be good. They need him to be good, and they need Zach Root to get back maybe to the level of pitcher that he was in March when he threw seven innings against South Carolina, and he went 7 2/3 against Vanderbilt. And I think, you know, I mean, like we've seen it. We've seen it from him, but he's got to get back to that point.
Yeah, they have to be getting longer outings from these starters. It's something Dave's talked about, you know, last weekend, and something a trend we've started to see where they're just not getting enough out of their starters. And I do think when you look at Texas's offensive numbers in SEC play, they're kind of just average.
They
you know,
are.
It's but really
their pitching
what's
is
exactly
phenomenal.
Exactly. So, I do think, you know, depending on what happens for Arkansas offensively, I do think maybe there's a chance that some of the starters have a better opportunity to kind of to be able to go a little bit longer.
All right, I want to give you a chance to promote these stories that you're doing, this Faces in the Crowd series on our website.
Yeah, so this has been really fun. It was just kind of, I don't really even remember how the idea started because I've done, I think, seven of them now. So I've been doing this for 7 weeks, I guess. But it's been a really fun series of stories. I think really where it started was, you know, over, I can't remember when exactly it happened, but it was before the season started when Camden Riley, who was a baseball fan that a lot of people knew, passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know him. I didn't know his name well. But just after he passed away, he had cancer. A lot of people, there was just, you know, an outpouring on social media of everybody talking about, you know, how so many people knew him and he was so close to all these people. And it kind of got me thinking about what a community there is in the hog pen of the people that are camping out, the people that are first in line, the people that get on that front row and even beyond, you know, how, what a community that is. And I was like, well, and you and I had talked in years past about, you know, wanting to get us do a story on the flags that are out there and things like that. So I've always been interested in fan stories like that. And so kind of just got out there. I started with Christina Barnes, who is the girl who knits, because I knew of her before. She and my sister were in grad school together. So I knew who she was, and had seen her, you know, with the knitting. So I started with her. And then really what has happened, I was originally going to do it with just one. I was going to do one the week of every home series. So that was going to be what, five? And the more people I talked to, everybody that I talked to would tell me, oh, you've got to talk to this person. And so they just kept giving me more and more ideas and getting me in touch with people. And I was like, I'm just going to do one every week. And it's been really fun. You know, a lot of it's interesting because a lot of these people are friends with each other. A lot of them are connected. So you kind of learn, there's a lot that you learn about them as you get to know different people. But it's been really fun. You know, it's a very unique group out there. There's a lot of different, you know, they all kind of know each other. The way people have told me is that Cam was really kind of the center of it. Like a lot of people, he knew everybody, and then people became friends through him, which is really interesting. But it's been fun. You know, there's so many like quirky traditions out there and interesting characters.
Well, so it's almost like a carnival community in that everybody has their niche.
Yes.
And I don't mean that negatively at all. It's everybody's got their niche that they're known for. You wrote about people this morning who are known for the shrimp.
Yep.
You've written about people who are known for cookies. Mm-hmm. The lady you mentioned who knits during a baseball game, and many, many more. I think it's kind of fascinating. It's an interesting peek into a group of people that it's easy just to look at them from a 30,000 foot view and say, look, there's 3,000 or 4,000 people who are sitting out there on the hill. You get in there, and obviously, it's like that old on CBS Evening News every Friday. They did this thing, Everybody's Got a Story. And that's kind of what this is.
Exactly. And it's been fun to get to know them that way. And, you know, some of them, one guy has been coming out there since like 2009, and others have been coming for 10 years, and a couple have been coming for 4 or 5. So it's interesting, you know, how some of them have been around for longer. There's kind of some newer people, and they all kind of just sort of adopt this community. And yeah, it's fun how everybody kind of has their own little tradition or niche, like you said. And you know, there's lots of fans out there that are, you know, just as cool and interesting that maybe don't have like an identifiable characteristic that you want to write a story about, that are just as, you know, interesting and cool and whatever. But it's been fun to kind of pick out people this way that have an interesting story to share.
I've got a notebook on our website, too. You can read it. It is titled Digging Into the Razorbacks History Versus Number One Teams. This was quite the rabbit hole to jump down. You know, if you know anything about college baseball, there's like before 2 years ago, there were six major polls that you had to monitor. Baseball America, D1 Baseball, Coaches Poll, Baseball Writers Poll, Perfect Game, and then used to the old Collegiate Baseball newspaper, which was the original poll that launched in 1959. Trying to figure out how many games a team has played against number one teams is impossible. You can't do it. It's not, number one, the record keeping in baseball has not been very good, and that's not to say anything bad about the people who are in charge now, but for years and years and years, the record keeping just was not very good. It's improved. I would say it got a lot better when Chad Crunk was Arkansas's baseball SID. He's now the head media relations person for the Detroit Tigers and has been for several years. So this is somebody who really knew what he was doing. John Thomas did a good job for several years, and now Oliver Grigg, who's in his fifth year, has done a good job as well. But, you know, in the 70s, 60s, 80s, the baseball record keeping just real, real sporadic, even into the 90s. From what I can find, tomorrow's game will be at least, and I say at least because I know full well we may be missing games, it'll be at least the 80th game that Arkansas has played against a number one ranked team, and it will be at least the 25th game that Arkansas has played against a number one Texas team. Texas, obviously, in the 80s had a ton of highly ranked teams. It's hard to really get a feel and pin down exactly when there were weekly rankings that assign number one, number two, whatever. A lot of these polls started as end of year polls. And then somewhere along the way, they became weekly rankings. So again, it's hard to find, but it was kind of interesting to go back and find some of these games where it's like, I don't know that I would have known that team was number one at that time.
Yeah, it's funny when you get into something like that and then you're writing it up and you have to add all these qualifiers and conditions to things like at least this many, or we know there's this many until as far back as this is how far the records go. And, you know, you have to add all these stipulations to it, which is very funny. You called me yesterday and I knew you were fixated on it. And I was like, he's going to get to the bottom of it. He's going to go through the records as best he can.
Yeah, it was a tough find. The most recent game, give you a few highlights of this, the most recent game that Arkansas played against a number one ranked team in any poll was LSU in 2023. That was that series down in Baton Rouge where Arkansas won an extra inning game in game one. LSU swept a doubleheader. The last time that a number one ranked team in any poll came to Fayetteville was LSU in 2015. They were number one in baseball America. And, then you go on down the list. The first game that Arkansas played against any number one ranked team was Texas in 1982. Kind of interesting. They played Texas when Texas was number one at Ray Winder Field in Little Rock. I mean, there's all kinds of interesting little notes in here. They beat Wichita State when Wichita State was number one in 1992, snapped a 48-game home win streak for Wichita State under Gene Stephenson. So, lots of cool little nuggets in there. You can read that there. Also a note, tomorrow's game will be the 1,000th college game played at Baumwalker Stadium.
That's awesome.
How about that?
That was the thing I was really surprised that you found, because that's not really something that they keep up with in any public way.
That's one of those when you've got too much time on your hands, you're like, I wonder. One day, this has been 2 or 3 months ago. Well, it was actually what prompted this was Arkansas won its 700th game at Baum in February. And so it's like, I wonder how many games they played there. And, you add it up. It's like, they played this many. And then I thought, but there have been a lot of NCAA regional games that have been played there that did not include Arkansas. And so that's what this is. It's not Arkansas's 1,000th game at the ballpark. It's the 1,000th college game that's been played at the ballpark tomorrow night.
It would have been a huge bummer if you'd done all that math and then found that they were at 1,002 or something.
I've had moments like that. Not on the games, but I've had moments like that where I'm looking up something like, God darn, I could have had it. If I would have looked this up 2 weeks ago, I would have had some sort of neat note, historical, whatever.
You got in just in time, this one.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got, I'm probably batting about 250 at that. I'll miss several. All right, Christina, appreciate you being here. You can read all of our Razorback coverage on our website at wholehogsports.com. Again, we appreciate Joe Healy from D1 Baseball for being on our podcast today. Bubba Carpenter is going to be in studio tomorrow as we preview this Arkansas-Texas series at Baum Walker Stadium. Hope to see you on our podcast. Have a great day, everybody.